Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this first part of the show, you'll hear an interview that I recorded last week with architect and urban planner Andres Duany, one of the leaders of a movement in urban planning and design known as New Urbanism. It's something that arose in response to the suburban sprawl that has become so common in the last 50 years, roughly. It works to introduce traditional features into new communities, making them pedestrian-friendly places where people live close to their work and shopping and recreation. He was visiting the campus last week, gave a talk in the MillerCom series, and sat down Thursday morning in the studio with us to do this interview. So as you listen, do keep in mind that in this first hour of Focus 580, we will not be taking your phone calls. You know, I think that probably people who work in urban design and who are architects know about the new urbanism, but there will be some people for whom this is a new term. So let me ask you to start to talk about the basics of the new urbanism. What does that mean?
Well, it's a reform movement that actually emerged to compensate or to mitigate the problems of suburbia. You know, when suburbia was first posited in the 50s in this country, when it really took off as the post-war model, there were great expectations for it. It was going to give the freedom of movement of the car. It was going to be living in nature. It was going to be about the single-family house. And these promises actually crashed. They turned out to consume a lot of land, to basically trash nature. The commercial strip developments are hideously ugly. And you spend your free time, in fact, commuting. And it's very costly. It's very costly to society. It's also very costly privately to own all those cars. And so it manifested itself in a kind of crashing in which people were against growth. You know, despite the need for growth, because the population keeps growing, there's a huge backlash in which growth has a bad name. And the new urbanism emerged by saying, look, we need to have the growth, but it doesn't need to be in the suburban sprawl's pattern. We can continue to build the towns and villages and neighborhoods of the past that, in fact, allow you to walk, allow you to use transit. They're mixed use. They have diversity intrinsic to them. And that we did fine for 250 years building traditional towns and neighborhoods. And why not go back to that? And that is the essence. Then a bunch of people who believed this and knew how to do it got together and founded a movement called the Congress for the New Urbanism. And we've been around for 14 years or so. And actually being effective.
You and other people who are interested in this approach have designed communities from the ground up that have these kind of qualities. Right. Important features are our walkability, mm-hmm. our integration of where you live, where you work, and where you
shop
and
go to school,
go
play,
to school mm-hmm. and all that sort of thing. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about what are the distinguishing features of a community like that. If one had the ability to mm-hmm. start from scratch, bare ground, and build something up, yeah. what a community with these kinds of values mm-hmm. looks like.
Well, the new urbanism, before I sort of emphasize that too much, is also about working in the inner cities and infilling. The first act, the preference, is to infill. And actually, because that, in fact, will not accommodate the numbers of people who are coming. All over this country, we must also do what are called greenfield work. There's infill and greenfield in urbanism. But the greenfield looks very much physically like the traditional town, say, of the 1920s. You know, not the 19th century, before the car entirely, but the 1920s, which we find are the most valued parts of every city. You know, the 1920 neighborhood is really where people want to live. We adjust them, of course. It's not straight 1920. For example, we provide modern infrastructure. We provide actually more parking, paradoxically enough, than the original neighborhoods. But we do try to build the main streets, like the old way. But they're managed like shopping centers. You know, in other words, they're centrally managed, although they are, in fact, walkable. And like physically like main streets, they're managed like shopping centers. There's a lot of hybriding in the new urbanism. You know, you can walk, but you don't have to. You can also drive. It's all about increasing choice. It's not about preventing people. You know, there's a kind of radical wing of the movement that says you must not drive. SUVs are bad, etc. But most mainstream new urbanists, in fact, really want to increase the choice. They think that walking is a right, walking to ordinary daily needs is a right. it is not something that should be mandated, but it should be possible. And that's the attitude. Now, you know, the art was lost. And one of the things we spent years doing is relearning how to make these towns and villages again. And there's some rough stuff in the beginning, but we're much better at it now.
Mm. It's my understanding, looking at your biography, that you have been involved in two firms, two important, influential firms. Mm-hmm. And the first one, which is in what I have read about it, has been characterized as modernist. Mm-hmm. And that then the second firm is the one that is interested in pursuing the kind of design here that you've been talking about. And I'm interested in how it is you went from one to the other and what it is that, and I'm assuming with Arquitectonica you were doing something very different. What it is that led you to decide that you wanted to go in a different direction?
Right. Well, first of all, the issue of the new urbanism is definitely not about style. You know, new urbanist communities can and are traditionalist or modernist in their architectural expression. What we are not modernist in is the planning. The planning is always traditional. You know, we do not make sort of vast super blocks with buildings, you know, floating in a sea of green with parking lots in front and, you know, with we don't believe in highways and overpasses and so forth. You know, we believe in traditional planning. We do not have a stake in the style of it. And actually, Seaside, our first new urbanist community, in fact, has quite a few modernist buildings along with the traditional ones. Arquitectonica was an entirely modernist firm. It was an ideologically modernist firm, but it didn't do planning. It did these sort of marvelously effective, media effective, sculptural buildings, particularly in Miami. Mm-hmm. And they looked great from a distance. But when you actually approach them, they actually don't affect society in any particular way. You know, they don't affect the street life. They don't. They're monocultures. Everybody in those high rises is the same income group. They're not mixed use. And we just became increasingly interested in not just affecting, let us say, the history of architecture, you know, by affecting the evolution of style. We became much more interested in affecting society, particularly a society that was having as many problems as the American middle class. And, you know, we're very sympathetic with the good old American middle class. You know, they work pretty hard to get what they have, and their environment serves them rather badly. You know, a lot of what they buy with their hard-earned money, they really don't need. And not in a kind of a purist or Puritan way. They shouldn't have to buy all those cars, you know. They shouldn't have to internalize so many of the things that they have in their McMansions. You know, you really shouldn't have to have a media room inside. You know, if it weren't that the multiplex was such a humiliating experience, you know, you shouldn't have three places to dine inside the breakfast room and the cafe room. If it weren't so hard to get to the corner cafe, you know, you wouldn't need such a huge kitchen if you could actually get more easily to a small grocery store. You know, you have to shop for a whole week. And so Americans spend a lot of time earning the money to buy these things, all the cars and the biggest houses, that in fact they wouldn't need if these houses were in a neighborhood. And I think that they seem a little bit crazed these days, the Americans, with, they seem to be in sort of in a permanent ill humor, you know, due to lack of time, you know, commuting everywhere. Everything requires a car trip, including taking your kid to play with another kid. You know, whatever happened with the kid getting himself over to the next... But they can't do it. They can't get to the next subdivision. They can't get to the baseball field. And everybody's just consumed with commuting, and their money is consumed with commuting, too, not only their time.
The examples of new urbanist communities that I have seen, particularly ones like Seaside and like the community that you did that's in the Washington, D.C., Kentlands, in the Washington, D.C. area, they do have a unified architectural style, and maybe that's what you can do if you're starting from the ground up. Mm. And they do tend to be traditionalist in approach. And I guess I one of the things that I was wondering about is whether you think that that's something that is important, that it has a kind of unified style, or is that only an artifact of the fact that you are starting with nothing and you can do that?
Well, actually, there are two. First of all, they're all different. You know, the communities are different. They have different degrees of codes that actually cause them to actually be, let's say, more harmonious or not. You know, so you can't, it's hard to generalize, but let me actually give the most constant condition. First of all, Seaside is rather high quality in its design, and Kentlands is rather low quality. And it represents the fact that one is a resort where people actually live kind of in a utopian manner. They really do want to live a more beautiful life. You know, the 2 weeks that we give ourselves a year in vacation. While Kentlands is a kind of, you know, it's an everyday community. And it manifests itself in that Kentlands is more conservative, it's more normal in its architecture. You know, it's more rudimentary. Seaside has won lots of prizes, Kentlands none, for example, for purposes of architecture. Now, where's the look of the architecture? First of all, Seaside is very lightly coded. And actually, there's a good dozen very good and even radical modernist buildings at Seaside. But that's a dozen out of 350. Now, what's that ratio about? That ratio is because Americans, on the whole, prefer traditional buildings. And we all know that. When it comes to their houses, they prefer traditional buildings. And because we leave that open to individual selection, which is very much, I think, the right of the citizen is to choose their, you know, within the limits of the urbanism, they have a right to choose the look of their, particularly their house. That is the ratio we're finding. Now, it varies. For example, in Miami Beach, there's another community we're doing called Aqua that is 100% modernist because that's what the local culture is about. I suppose that in Colorado, there's one called A Prospect that is 50-50. You know, it's 50-50. In the Washington area, which is extraordinarily conservative in its manifestations of architecture, it's 100% traditionalist, you know. And what you're seeing is actually really the popular culture, you know, affecting it. I am willing, in fact, to impose, if asked, a greater degree of harmony. Either, you know, we're, as you already said, I've been a modernist architect. I'm also a traditionalist architect. I don't have a dog in that fight, you know. But I will certainly ask whether they want control that leads to a high degree of harmony or whether the citizens want to let go and then have a kind of more interesting mix. What I have actually found is that when you mix things, modernism and traditionalism, because they're ideologically opposed, they're not just neutral. They actually don't like each other. The modernists don't like the traditionalists. They have contempt for them. The traditionalists have contempt for the modernists. This manifests itself in a very disharmonious environment. And those communities that are 50-50, like Prospects, there's not a great deal of unity in the community. You know, there's a kind of friction that manifests itself in the visual friction. That's the way it is. We're, you know, this is a country of enormous variety, and they should have that choice. Yeah.
For people who are listening to this hour, Focus 580, I should introduce again our guest. We're talking with architect, urban planner Andres Duany. This is a pre-recorded interview. That means we're not in this hour of the show taking calls. If you're interested, by the way, in doing a little bit more reading on the subject, you might look at one of the books that he contributed to. His book was first published in 2000 and is available in a paperback edition published by North Point Press. This book is titled Suburban Nation, The Rise of Sprawl and the Decline of the American Dream. So if you're interested in reading some more about these basic ideas. I'm interested in just following up what you were talking about, because I imagine that people who have seen, again, examples of these kinds of communities will think about Seaside, and maybe will think about Celebration, the community that Disney
but
did.
Which we did not design.
Which you, yes, yeah. Yes. You
same not. Principles, though.
Same ideas. And will maybe respond negatively to them in the sense that they say that they are over-designed, there was too much uniform. And again, I suppose that depends on what it is that you're interested in, what it is your idea of the ideal place to be would be. But for people who have that kind of criticism, I guess I wonder how you think about that.
Well, it's just a matter of factually correcting them. You know, for example, Prospect has been in the cover of Dwell magazine, you know, extravagantly published, and they just don't connect. They don't connect Dwell or that publication with you know, with it being a new urbanist community. You know, Seaside has been so successful that it has become the image of the new urbanism. But we've done about 100 communities since then, you know, and they manifest different degrees, different ideas, you know, about particularly about architecture. But I'll tell you something. When I lecture and when I write, I don't talk about architectural style. I don't find it particularly important. And that's one of the reasons. I don't spend a lot of time correcting that misconception. I speak about a lot of other things that are more urgent. You know, the enormous growth rate of this country, how will they be accommodated? You know, which is now tearing apart the Sierra Club, you know, the debate on immigration, whether the Sierra Club is going to come out against immigration or not. Debate occurring right now. 40 million Americans are coming in 20 years. The whole live-work problem, we all really want to work at home. The codes don't allow it. The problem of the traffic engineers and how they actually have a conception of the roadways that remount the pedestrian places instead of actually making the public realm, which our streets are in America. You know, this, thereby destroying, in a way, the fabric of society. If streets are unpleasant to even stand on, where do we meet, you know? Only in the malls, it seems. Or not meet at all, you know? There's so many things to talk about that even when somebody gives me 3 hours to go on, and I only have 50 minutes today, I don't get to the architectural style issues because they're so down the line. Now, the architects, of course, and by the way, the planners understand this, the environmentalists understand this, the traffic engineers are happy, but the architects are so obsessed by style because it's what they live and die on, their stand on style. It's their image. It's their self-regard, you know, it's their presence in the world is the style of buildings, that they always come back to style. If I do lecture in an architecture school, which I seldom do, because, you know, we're non grata in architecture schools, they, I will talk about it, and I will talk about coding and the issues, you know, all the things. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not inexperienced in this, but it doesn't come up in general discussion. And so this misconception continues to. It's in our charter. The Charter of the New Urbanism has an entire section dedicated saying that style is not an issue. It's not about architectural style. But there's only so much you can do. There's an unwillingness to research what we're actually about in the architecture schools and in the architectural world, and so they put forth this misconception.
So why you just touched on that, I guess I have to, having said it, I have to ask, why is it you think that you're not welcome in architecture schools?
Well, it's a very, we used to be. I mean, in 1990 or 91, Harvard, the Harvard Graduate School of Design, had a major exhibit on our work with a quite substantial catalog, the size of a book, that in fact was is still in print and is sold, God knows how much. I was Gropius visiting professor and lecturer that year. I've been visiting professor at Harvard and Yale and Princeton and so forth. And then things switched. And I think what happened was that the academy, taking on the critical position that they feel must have, as soon as we became the dominant position intellectually, like the discourse is now dominated by new urbanism, we were, as soon as we became the insiders, which happened about 96, 97, 98. You know, we were the terms of the discourse. The academy switches and actually becomes, you know, the outsider. It actually takes the critical stance. And that's what they've done obsessively. Now, which is fine because actually architects aren't very powerful. It's okay what the architectural academy feels. Now, it's not okay what the environmentalists feel because they're really powerful. The environmental groups of this country, we have to be very, very careful and engaging because they're truly powerful. The planners are truly powerful. The political entities are truly powerful. The developers are truly powerful. What the architects think, frankly, I mean, we really, I just don't have the time for them. Mm-hmm. You know, so I don't. I really don't. And even when I lecture at an architecture school, as I did yesterday in a joint lecture here, you know, at Illinois, I did not address the issues of architecture. I spoke about environmentalism.
There is, associated with this approach to community planning that we've been talking about, the new urbanism, there's a certain set of values that has to do with people and how they connect to one another and how they relate to one another. Mm-hmm. And there's this idea that the way the community is laid out mm-hmm. either works for that or against
right.
it. And the idea is that with this kind of design, you're getting back to a kind of connectedness, a kind of community that existed when communities were laid out
right.
differently.
Right.
The big question I think a lot of people are asking is this. Well, you can design a new community with these principles with the hope that mm-hmm. this kind of community of relationships will be formed. But
right.
the question is, well, does that actually okay. happen?
Okay. First of all, the new urbanism is variegated within the community. One of the premises is that it's not a monoculture. You know, it's not like a subdivision that has only houses or an apartment cluster that has only apartments or townhouses. It's variegated. And it has what we call a transect that goes from rural to urban. Within a properly designed urbanist communities, there's a main street living above the shop and live-work units, very intensely, one would say almost communal. Then there's a kind of middle ground, which is messy and can go either way. And then there's a section, which is not unlike suburban living, in which you're very isolated. And sometimes we don't even build sidewalks, because some Americans prefer to not relate to their neighbors. And actually, the new urbanism includes them all, right, within a community. And that's the source of the diversity. It's a diversity of characters, not necessarily a diversity of income, you know, because actually, frankly, our communities, regardless of how affordable they begin, they end up expensive because they're nice. People bid them up. But within that, there's a variety of people, you know, that have different degrees of behavior patterns, all of which are accommodated. Very different from suburbia, by the way, in which everybody has to drive in the hermetic automobile, regardless of whether you live in a townhouse or an apartment building, etc. So now, whether that in fact does affect behavior, there's a big theoretical proposition that design, physical design, does not affect behavior. Okay? Now, this is a relative innovation that arose in the 70s. In the teens and 20s, with the forming of the profession, it was absolutely evident to everybody concerned that design did affect behavior. That's what the parks movement was about. That's what, you know, there was a great deal of care taken with the first half of the century in the fact that design would affect behavior. But a crisis occurred in the 1960s. Designers, after half a century of success, were actually handed the American cities absolutely, which is what happened in the 60s. And the designers had this new untested idea of demolishing the old traditional neighborhoods and building towers in the park. And that was going to make a much better world. You know, sun and light and air and more greenery. And it turns out, and they did do amazing things. The power designers had and planners was astounding. And you could see, you know, you've seen in Chicago and New York and everywhere what this program was. And there was confidence that people would actually be happier. That failed abysmally, as we know. That backlash took with it the lesson, which I believe is an erroneous lesson. It basically said, these people said, wow, how unexpected. People became barbarians. Now, instead of saying, they became barbarians because they responded to the barbaric idea that we gave them, they concluded, oh, it must be that design does not affect behavior, that there are other factors. And so the conclusion was, because of that failure, not that design is so incredibly effective of behavior, that we actually took viable communities and within half a dozen years turned them to barbaric communities, which should have been the lesson. Boy, design is really powerful. They said, oh, design can't affect behavior. And so that became embedded in the intellectual tradition in which architecture and the history of architecture became independent of its ability to affect society. And postmodernism, of which this building we're in is an example, understands architecture as an autonomous discipline. Like every architect then now does not attempt to affect society, they attempt to affect the history of architecture. The next masterpiece that I do will actually deflect architecture in a new way, and I will thereby become immortal. And that is, in fact, what architects are doing. They've Frank Gehry and Zaha Hadid, all these buildings just affect the history of architecture. They have absolutely no notion of affecting society. It's just like it makes the person famous and you get disciples. That was an erroneous conclusion. The correct conclusion is that design can affect behavior. We found that out very early when we started building Seaside, which is actually very closely modeled on communities where people walked and knew their neighbors. Lo and behold, astoundingly, people got to know their neighbors and they walked. And if you go to Kentlands right now, sometimes I've been sitting in our office in Kentlands, which is a very large community, 10,000 people live there, and we get a call from somebody like you, you know, interviewing us. We understand that you think that design doesn't affect behavior. Well, we don't believe that. And I look out the window and I see the kids walking, little kids walking by themselves to the movies, to the town center in Kentlands, where they've all negotiated, you know, the $2 lunch, that they know where it is, and where the kids from elsewhere come and gather, and where the parents don't know where they are but know where they are, and that the kids from other areas get dropped off to spend the entire weekend because it is so different to be a kid in Kentlands than it is in a subdivision. And you say, what Martian is interviewing me here? Like, have they no powers whatsoever of observation? Are they not able to see that a kid that lives in a cul-de-sac is an absolutely a cul-de-sac kid, able to get anywhere only because their mom drives them there? That the minute they leave the cul-de-sac, which indeed is safe, they hit an arterial that they can't cross. While at Kentlands, the kids have, Lord knows, what is it? How big is Kentlands? They have, 1,200 acres, or excuse me, 470 acres, and 10,000 people that they can get to, and movies and shops and literally every, and schools and elementary schools and playing fields that they can get to on their own, and they adore it. In fact, kids often drive the purchasers, the parents to purchase in these places. Of course design affects behavior. I mean, if you can incubate your own business in your live-work unit, you don't have to work for a corporation because the mortgage is allowing you to start your business. And there are, you know, there are 50 or 60 businesses and live-work units at Kentlands. That's a different behavior pattern, deeply different. Anyway, so just observe, you know, less theory, more observation, please.
Let me introduce again our guest for anybody who has recently tuned in. We're talking with designer, architect, urban planner Andres Duany. He is the co-founder of the Congress for the New Urbanism. He is also principal architect of the firm of Duany Plotter Zyberk. The Plotter Zyberk is his wife, who is also a partner in the firm. And we're talking about some of the ideas of this approach to urban design called the New Urbanism. And as I mentioned a little while ago, if you're interested in reading more about this, you might look at a book that he contributed to. It was published first in 2000. It's titled Suburban Nations, published by the North Point Press. This is a recorded interview, by the way, this morning, and that means we're not taking calls in this part of the show. Last year, I believe, was the 15th anniversary of Kentlands.
Yeah, it is. It was.
And
yes.
It was. Now looking at it now, are there things that you would say, well, if we had this to do this over again, there are some things we might do differently?
Always. It's interesting because urbanism is about it's not about largers. It's not about size. You know, it's if we were to have designed all the buildings, it wouldn't be urbanism. It would just be a large architectural project. It would be a monoculture with a tendency to fail cataclysmically. You know, either succeed absolutely or fail. What we do is we set up the situation in which others sequentially can make decisions. When that happens, many, many things are worse than if you had done them yourself. On the other hand, many, many things are better than if you would have done them yourself. There's a degree of care and variety that cannot be falsified, that a single designer cannot falsify. Kentlands looks like a real place, okay, and that is enormously attractive, in fact, to because it cools down the Disney World, you know, effect. That's, you know, which, for example, Celebration was much more coherently designed at once, you know, instead of the sequence, which I believe is essential to. I think one of the great ingredients of urbanism is time. You actually build in time, and it's not just size, it's time. So Kentlands, to give an example, has some things that are much worse than if we had done them, some things much better. And you always look at the balance and say, and you try to look at the good stuff, not being uncritical, but looking at the good stuff. What's interesting about Kentlands is that we did a 15-year tune-up. And we had built into Kentlands has some big box retail, very useful stuff. You know, actually has a 70,000 square foot supermarket. It has a Kmart and it has a Home Depot, which actually are virtually all you need is there. And it's a horrible looking thing, but it it made a walkable community. It's actually much more self-contained. But we set up the parking lot in such a way that it could be urbanized. You know the terrible parking lots in front? We set them up so they could be built upon, like city blocks. And now that's happening. The land is so valuable that cars are being taken out of these horrible parking lots and apartment buildings put in. So you can see the town center, 15 years later, becoming urban without losing the big boxes. And what we were setting it up for that. We also did another thing, which was interesting. There was no conception of transit in Kentlands, you know, 15 years ago. And now a rail line is coming up from Washington. And because Kentlands has a pedestrian shed, it has 10,000 people within walking distance of a potential station, we were actually studying the very real possibility that the rail would be deflected into Kentlands to pick up the transit riders. Because, you know, people, there's very high ridership when people can walk to transit. You know, once people get in the car, they tend to keep driving. If you can catch people as pedestrians, they will take transit. You know, if you can capture them with that intermodal change. And this is what we're doing. We're tuning it up. And what I've learned is that you really do have to look past the present. When Kentlands was done, only certain things were possible. But you have to set it up so that the place molds. You know, like all American towns, they all began as, including this campus of yours, this beautiful campus. I saw what the early buildings looked like. They were, you know, there was, this place was a shanty town, frankly, you know, in the 19th century, mm-hmm. without sewer, without water, without indoor plumbing. It looked like a shanty town. But it was conceived in such a way that it could become great. And it did become great. And that's the way we like to think about things. We like to say, well, while the possibilities may be limited for this community at this moment, we know the limits very well. We will set it up so it can molt and evolve and someday become great, can even become true urbanism, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that's what we saw at Kentlands.
You touched on something that I was curious about, and that is when you design a place, if you do have that luxury of designing from the ground up, the day comes when you say, essentially say you're finished, you cut the ribbon, but mm-hmm. that doesn't, but it's not done. Mm-hmm. Which I guess the idea is that it should continue to evolve. And mm-hmm. so my question is, well, how long does it take, do you think, for it to become what it's going to be? And I saw one answer is, well, never. But is there some period of time, would you say, you know, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, mm-hmm. it has to mature in a sense?
Well, first of all, we hand over very quickly. We believe the longer we're on it, the more we affect it, and it becomes essentially like designing it. We hand over almost completely after we design code and permit, you know, to other designers. So it gets that authenticity that comes from many hands, you know, which I think is particular to our new urbanism, you know, the DPZ, new urbanism. Some other people really like to make more perfect places. They hold on longer. But let me just say, to answer the question, we have never finished a project, not even Seaside. It's still under construction. And then it's already demolishing. The first generation is being demolished and rebuilt with, unfortunately, bigger and more expensive houses, but nevertheless. We have, for example, we did another project called Windsor, which won't be finished for 50 years. I mean, it has polo fields of all things, you know? But we designed the polo fields so they can be urbanized and become a downtown 50 years from now. So I'll never see it. I do ask that you wait 10 to 15 years before you assess the urbanism. You know, people came in early in Kentlands and said, oh, you know, in books, this has appeared in books. Oh, the town center doesn't work. It's not going to happen. The town center is not going to happen in Kentlands. It's all a fraud. Well, 15 years later, there are three town centers, not one, but three. And I always say, anybody who assesses urbanism, A, without giving it time, doesn't know what they're doing, and B, without spending at least 2 days there. It's not about pictures. It's not what it looks like. You have to wake up in the morning, walk out, see what the coffee's like, see whether they sell the New York Times, and then stay up as late as you can and see whether you can get a martini at night at midnight, you know? And that is the way you test urbanism. You have to throw trash on the ground, see whether it gets picked up, see whether people are friendly. You just live it. Urbanism is not about looks. That's the way you judge architecture. Urbanism is how you live the day. And I would always spend a weekday and then a Saturday. Like, for example, people at Kentlands. They go and say, I visited Kentlands, there was no one walking. And I said, when did you go? Well, it was 3 o'clock on a Thursday. Well, what do you think? People don't work? Do you know, like, what kind of assessment is that, 3 o'clock on Thursday? You have to spend the whole of Friday and the whole of Saturday and then see how it works. And I mean the whole. You have to be the first person up and the last person in bed. That doesn't mean what you're going to learn is good or that you're going to like it. But I will respect your assessment. You know, but I will not respect somebody that has made a two-hour visit or has seen it in photographs. It's just not the way you assess urbanism.
Earlier on, you were talking about what are the hallmarks of this kind of approach to laying out a community, and walkability is one of the things that's high on the list,
right?
That people should be able to from where they live, should be able to walk to restaurants and to shopping, and the kids should be able to walk to school.
What we call the ordinary daily needs.
Ideally, it seems that you would like to have that same accessibility of people to their work. And this seems to be the one thing that would be, if that's what you wanted to do, would be the most difficult thing.
Yeah.
You can do the other. You can build houses and you can build shopping centers and mm-hmm. you can build schools and you can get all that to come together.
Mm-hmm.
But to get to that idea where people could actually also live that close to the place that they work,
yeah.
That seems to me that's the toughest part,
yeah.
If that's what you wanted to do.
It's the one that takes the longest. Because, for example, because people like, say, Kentlands, that doesn't mean they're giving up their job. They like the lifestyle of the community. They like what it does for their kids. They like the school, whatever. They like to walk to movies. But they're not going to give up their job. But what happens is this. All towns molt. People change. The next time, when the workplaces are near Kentlands, there's a lot of office buildings immediately adjacent to Kentlands, virtually attached, and more coming. Those people, when they actually come in, will naturally look to live in Kentlands, you see, because now the businesses are in. And there will be an increasingly higher relationship between proximity of work and housing over the years. It can happen at the beginning, but in the end, because the incentive is that traffic and commuting is becoming so awful. So it's not one of these punitive ideas in which we will punish you if you don't live close to work. You know, it's not like saying you must do it. You know, actually, it makes sense. It's a pleasure to be able to live near your work. So people will gradually, the market will tend or trend towards that because it makes more sense. The problem is that Kentlands was actually conceived in the 1990s when there was an enormous overbuilding of office buildings. So the offices came much later. They're just finishing the first two right now, 15 years later, the first office buildings. More are coming. But it took 15 years to actually get rid of the overhang of the 1990s. You know, that scandal of that overbuilding scandal. Mm-hmm. It affected Kentlands. It made it an asymmetrical place without enough workplace. 5 years from now, it'll be full of workplace in close proximity, and more people will be walking to work. And by the way, 40 years from now, why not? There may be an incredibly high incidence of that.
One of the criticisms that has been made of these communities, and you touched on it, is that because they're extremely desirable, people are bidding up the prices of the homes. And, and that for a lot of people, it would simply be inaccessible beyond their ability to afford.
Right. Yeah,
is that something that you can address?
Well, I'll tell you, for example, Seaside was originally so inexpensive. I actually sold my house and lot for $37,000. Okay, there were school teachers. There were two school teachers that held out until just now that had bought a very early house there, just elementary school teachers, and they finally couldn't resist. You know how much they were being offered for the site. Now, you could say, well, those school teachers, we should have actually docked them. We shouldn't have allowed them, you know, the price to go up so much. And I think it's profoundly unfair. I'm very much against actually having people who are smart enough to buy in one of our communities just because they got a good deal to prevent them from actually profiting. You know, why harass the less wealthy? And so only the wealthy can make money in real estate? No, everybody should do it. The only way to deal with this, there are two ways. We can actually do a lousier job, frankly. You know, there are buildings at Seaside that are actually much worse. And you know what? They don't go up in value. There's one apartment building that actually has hardly gone up in value at all. It's very interesting. You can actually do bad design. When you do a bad job, the prices don't go up, as HUD has found out, you know, in this country. You know, affordable housing badly done stays affordable. There's another way to do it, which is make it not so rare. The new urbanism has to be more common so that it doesn't get bid up. What's now, the problem now, is that it's a rare commodity because it's a tiny minority of what's built. There's usually one. It's relatively small. And the prices go up very, very high as anything that is, in fact, in limited quantity. Trouble is it's so hard to permit them because they're essentially illegal. You know, the current coding system allows only suburban sprawl. That's what's legal. All this stuff we don't like out there, that's in the code. Now, you try to build a traditional town, you need a lot of variances. And so it takes a very special kind of developer to, in fact, go through the process to build a traditional town. And that's holding the supply down. There's a supply problem. And we're trying to actually get that playing field leveled so that we can overcome the problem of the affordability. Mm-hmm.
I want to introduce one more time for people who might have just joined us. We're talking with urban planner architect Andre Stuani, and we're talking about the new urbanism and the approach that he and other people have been involved in trying to design new communities that have some of the values and the features of older communities. He's the co-founder of the Congress for the New Urbanism and is principal architect of the firm of Duani Plotter Zyberg Company. This is a recorded interview, by the way. Just do keep in mind that in this particular hour of the show, we're not taking calls. It seems to me that that this approach to design has been politicized in some interesting ways, in the sense that you and people who do the designing have been labeled as being on the left side of the political spectrum. And then what's also interesting is that people who live in the communities because it's been dubbed family values architecture. When you go around, you ask people who live in these communities what they're like. They look like they're conservative. So I think that's very interesting. And I don't know to what extent either of those things are truly true and whether they matter. Yeah. But I wonder what you think about that.
It's very interesting. Actually, we were politically naive at that level, at the level of ideology. We're not politically naive in terms of knowing where the power is and going for it, you know, and connecting to mayors and governors and so forth. But the problem was that actually Al Gore, of all marvelous people, and we do think he was a marvelous guy, actually took on this as a banner. Mm-hmm. And he positioned it on the left as part of the environmental solution. You know, people commuting less, people using less land, obviously pollute the air less. We affect the water with watersheds less and so forth. So this became part of the left's agenda. He dropped it very quickly, but he actually embedded it. And smart growth got that feeling, which is another way of actually speaking of new urbanism. Smart growth got the feeling there was an agenda of the left. Now, at the same time, developers actually discovered that they could make money on it. You know, and actually, it's actually largely market-driven. The people who actually build the new urbanist communities are not necessarily goody-goodies. You know, they just think that they can actually make a niche in the market, which is highly profitable. I can speak about these ideas, and if I am alerted as to who I'm speaking to, I can present this as part of the agenda of the left, or I can speak of this as part of the agenda on the right without any contradiction, because it delivers to both. What we're trying to do now is actually recover the new urbanism from being captured by the left, which it has been in the minds of the, let's say, the Republican Party. They think that smart growth is a kind of a left thing. Completely unwarranted, because actually developers do it for profit. And in fact, what we're trying to do is level the playing field so the market can decide. Right now, the playing field is not level, and the market is constrained. It cannot decide because it's so much harder to permit a new urbanist community. But if we level the playing field and the market decides, the Republicans will in fact understand that it's the market operating. But I think it's most I thought it was a terrible mistake on our part to allow it to be captured by one side of the political spectrum. Now that we've awoken to the problems when that happens, we're now actively recovering, you know, and actually repositioning it as actually non-ideological.
We have been, as we have been talking about new urbanism, and we've talked a little bit about a couple of examples, particularly these two high-profile projects that you've been involved in. It is in the sense of doing something from the ground up. But you said that doesn't necessarily have to be the case. And I guess I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about the idea of using these principles essentially as a retrofit. Mm-hmm. In urban mm-hmm. settings, places where there already is a built environment,
right. Yeah.
And you don't quite have that luxury of saying, here is a bare piece of ground, and we're mm-hmm. going to start from the very mm-hmm. beginning.
Do you know, the new urbanist firms have worked in inner cities. We, for example, our firm did the plan for Providence, Rhode Island, which is doing very nicely. We did the plan for Baton Rouge, which is doing very nicely, West Palm Beach. These are inner city areas that were actually in rough shape. We also did a few other towns in Florida that were in not so rough shape, but it was very helpful. Here is the problem. The problem is they say, well, what is so new urbanist about what you're doing? After all, the planning profession has been working in the inner city for 30, 40, 50 years and not doing a bad job. Why don't we just call it urbanism? This is a specific criticism. Why isn't it just urbanism? Why is it new urbanism? Or, in fact, why isn't it just old urbanism that you're trying to revive? This is what we bring to the table. We are constantly aware that we're competing against the suburbs. When we work in an inner city, we don't look at it from the inside. We look at it from the outside. What does it feel like to a person about to move into this town and they have a choice between an inner city house and a brand new suburban ranch house? The merchant coming in, do they occupy a street, a place in Main Street? Do they lease a shopfront in Main Street, or do they go to the shopping mall? The corporation coming in about to build an office building for themselves, do they go downtown? How is that different from the experience of building out in an office park, a pre-permitted office park? This, and by the way, the short answer is the inner city does not compete. It is irrational to actually move into the inner city, open a store in the inner city, and build an office building in an inner city, because actually the suburban developers are so, you know, they're so smart and agile about things that actually the city is non-competitive. What the new urbanists do in the city is make it competitive again, looking at it with an eye very much on the suburbs. Now, that is what's new urbanist about it. The old planners always looked at the needs of the inner city from within the inner city. It was an insider's look of the inner city. So they said, you know, we need more affordable housing, we need to fix the sidewalks, etc. The new urbanists look at it from the outside, and we're very effective. Like all the towns, all the inner cities we've worked in have really taken off, you know, because that's what it's about. The world now, you know, the old urbanism did not have to compete with suburbia. That is the new ingredient. And it isn't just one little ingredient. It is the whole thing. The whole thing is, how do you compete with the suburban developers who are so good and so highly subsidized, by the way? And since we work for them also, we are actually able to affect the inner city and make it competitive again. And it's a lot of fun, actually, to work in the inner city. However, what we do is not so visible. Like when you go to Providence right now and you see it all, it's filled now. You know, people are living in lofts, and the shops are in, and the theaters are working and everything. People don't know that they were empty 10 years ago. They think they were always that way. And so it is much less well known what the new urbanists do when it comes to inner city projects, is the record is not one from nothing to community. It's just a community that works again. And people actually forget that it wasn't working at one time. There was actually empty void with no value.
We're down to the point here. We have maybe about 3-4 minutes. We talked, asked you a little bit earlier about Kentlands, for example, the place that had been now a little over 15 years, and you talked about how last year you did a tune-up after that period of time and went back and looked at it and looked at what had happened and decided to make some changes. As a movement, New Urbanism, now that you've been doing it for a while, is there any sense in which you now say, well, let's question some of our original assumptions, some of our ideas, things that we thought at the beginning, well, maybe that was the way to go. And now, given experience, we might say, we should also give the whole movement a tune-up.
This is constant. This is the essence of the new urbanism, is how we actually challenge ourselves. That's the fun of it, actually. It's not the outside critics. You know, when an outside critic comes and says something, we just clarify the facts. That's not a real debate. The debate is what we bring in ourselves. Like, for example, what is it with the libertarians that are attacking us now that is correct about them? What is it? What is it about Walmart, you know, the great ogre, that actually does things better? Why is Walmart so imposing? Why is it so evident that there are good things about it? And, you know, that's, we could take an hour discussing that, and it's very interesting, actually. You know, but we ourselves become expert in Walmart. We ourselves become, I've done libertarian readings, you know, to learn what they're about. One of the things we've done is actually there was a misconception in the new urbanism about how we take on environmentalism. You know, about at one point we said, let's just make our communities greener. But what happened is that just makes them more suburban. And now we're recoiling from that and actually establishing new methods that actually allow us to actually judge things differently. Like the environmental performance isn't just with how green it is or how much impervious surface we've eliminated and so forth. But there's a constant criticism that actually is what actually keeps the best, the smartest people in the movement, because it's really evolving. I think that once we figured it out and we just became a teaching organization, we would lose, I think, the most interesting people. And it would just become an organization as opposed to a kind of, you know, we're really a kind of almost like a militant radical group at the moment because of the constant pressures we have from the outside. And whenever we have a day without pressure, we invent it for that day. You know, that's the personality type. Like, who are we going to fight today? And sometimes we have to actually evolve our own debates.
Give me 1 minute on what's good about Walmart.
Okay, among other things, well, let's look at it from the point of view of the public process. Walmart does deliver goods inexpensively to people who wouldn't otherwise have access to them. You know, they also pay a lot of taxes, for example. You know, they also create jobs. In fact, in yesterday's Wall Street Journal, there was a major editorial on what's good about Walmart. And it's just about balance with what's bad about Walmart. But it's stunning to see when you actually look at things from both points of view, both sides, it really makes this field of ours really interesting. And the new urbanists, by remaining non-ideological and actually, you know, seeing the virtues of both sides, I think it's what makes us strong. Like, you know, I will become an expert as this emerges now in what's wrong about Walmart, which I've read all those books already. I am now interested in what's good about Walmart, and so that I can actually, so I'm not sort of floored by an unexpected question. I want to be an expert in our, you know, we reconnoiter the opposition. You know, we need intelligence in what they're up to. And we do that all the time.
Well, I think we'll have to leave it at that. Andre Stuani, thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.